What's your secret to building worlds in your fiction and visual art?
I have to start with something familiar to me, whether it's an experience or a location or something to do with the job I have at the moment. I think jobs especially have something really mundane and forced about them where you have to show up every day and go and experience pretty much your whole range of emotions while you're there, whether you're hopeful about something in the future, whether you're just dead tired and don't want to be there. There's a lot of just real life in those sorts of things. So when it came to this story, The Obsoletes, it was drawn from my childhood growing up in Michigan in a small town. So that location drew from just a lot of my memories and also paging back through the old newspapers from that time and trying to include real details. Also, it focuses on a relationship between two brothers, and I have a brother who I'm very close to, and just sort of drawing on that relationship. Not that this is an autobiographical story, but the sort of way that with a sibling relationship, it's very intense. You feel very protective of someone one moment, and the next moment you can really hate their guts and need solitude. And that doesn't mean that it's a good relationship or a bad relationship. It just sort of is the truth about it. So kind of drawing on those feelings was a big part of creating the world for this book. And also being a middle school teacher, a lot of this book takes place in a high school, but I spend a lot of time around, you know, 14-year-old kids and just the way they relate to each other, the way they empathize and talk to each other, the speed that they think is something that I think finds its way into a lot of scenes in the book.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Simeon Mills about his adolescent robot novel, The Obsoletes. Don't go away. You beat me to the punch in talking about your brother, but we'll circle back around. So the book is centered around two basketball-obsessed robot brothers coming of age in robophobic Michigan in the 1990s. And reading it, I thought, yes, this is someone who understands sibling relationships. So rather than ask my original question, you know, what influence did your brother have on the book, I'm going to ask, how do you see yourself in both of the brother characters?
Well, I think the two brother characters are, there's one that's very protective and really is maybe better labeled just in terms of a job description as the mother of the characters. He refers to himself as the mom, and he sees to their upbringing and, you know, their daily requirements, and their biggest requirement is to hide their identities. And I'm older than my brother by 2 years, and I think probably talking about, if I'm going to talk about both myself and my brother, we're both in both of these characters too. I'm a little bit older than him, but I definitely see him as the more pragmatic of us. I go to him for advice. I see him as incredibly level-headed and wise, and I think about things that he, you know, he doesn't speak a whole lot. He doesn't talk a whole lot. He definitely doesn't lecture me. He's not like a mother figure to me, but I look up to him, even though he's my younger brother. So I think having that kind of way that I depend on him, and I've depended on his perspective, maybe found its way into Daryl, the protagonist and the character that thinks of himself as a mother figure. And then just we, both my brother and I grew up with a, on a farm that had a barn that had a cement floor and a couple basketball hoops in it. So we could play basketball all year round. So there was definitely a place where we could go out there and fantasize and play and just really believe that we could make the NBA someday. So having these brothers, have that kind of goal and dream was just really natural to me. And being a teacher too, being a teacher of kids that, you know, they don't know what they necessarily want to be when they grow up, but if, you know, they had to choose, it would be in the NBA. I absolutely relate to that. And I think my brother did too, for a while.
On the jacket, the book makes note to follow the directions, which there are three noted: keep a low profile, act human, and never be yourself. So what does it mean for a robot to never be his or herself?
Well, it's the be yourself would be the robot hidden inside of you, I guess. And if you were going to be yourself, you would be probably celebrating that. You would at least be able to talk about it with the other people in your life. And these robots don't even really get to talk about the fact that they're robots with each other. And to talk to any other of their classmates about it, any of the humans would be, they would be destroyed basically on the spot. So it's a part of themselves that is probably the most important part, but they can't talk about it. And it's also a mystery for them. They don't know about their creators. They have, I think, a lot of the same existential questions that we have about ourselves that we, you know, want to know about, that we really hunger for, but that's usually for late at night when you are alone and you, you know, you're not going to spend all day when you have your daily needs to tend to, wondering about, you know, what's the meaning of life, who exactly created us, that sort of thing. So in some sense, they're living a parallel lives to the humans around them. There are those mysteries, and there are things that they have to hide, and they have to hide this aspect of their identity. With these brothers in particular, one of them finds it much easier to just believe that he's human, so he doesn't even want to talk about the fact that he's a robot. So our protagonist is left to just think about that on his own and wonder what that means and just have to exist totally within his head, or his processor in this case.
You're simply one step ahead of me, because my next question was around the tension between Daryl and Kanga's perspective on being robots. And at one point you write, from Daryl's point of view, you don't get to decide if you're a robot or human. You're either one or the other. There's no in between. Look at my wrist. This is who we are. This is Daryl speaking to Kanga. Why is Daryl so eager to burst Kanga's bubble?
I think it's partly the brother thing. The way you can, if your sibling wants something or believes something really badly and maybe you think they're misguided about it, there's only so long that you can let that go on. In this particular case, it's just second nature for robots to assume they always need to hide their identities and just stay in the shadows, stay in the background, just observe the humans around them. Whereas Kanga's kind of broken all the rules. He first of all believes he's a human, but he also has joined the basketball team and has, you know, not hidden his remarkable abilities at basketball. So he's really popular. He's got these new friends, and things seem to be working out for him. So Daryl is very frustrated because he's following all of the rules that robots need to follow, and he's perhaps beginning to question whether or not he should be following those rules. But I think there's always a little bit of tension when you realize maybe your sibling is right, or maybe you should follow their lead. He doesn't really want to own up to that. So he's trying to bring Kanga back to Earth when he can. I think he also is really worried for his brother too, because the stakes of them being discovered as robots are really high.
Can we talk about Brooke Noon?
Sure.
Can you start by just describing her?
So when we meet Brooke, she is the manager on the basketball team, pretty much in name only. And it's a moment in the book where there's an intersection where the boys are at their first basketball practice and Brooke is there too. And it's 1991 and she has probably the earliest model of laptop computer. And our narrator, Daryl, is just taken with her, the way she's typing on it. Without looking at her hands, and she's He's just very impressed that she would have a computer by like the ones that he saw in a magazine. They grow to have a closer relationship, but she is definitely always one step ahead of Daryl in terms of calling the shots, in terms of dictating how he's going to feel about her, probably withholding the attention that she knows that he wants. But she's also someone that has a lot of secrets of her own and a pretty rich family history of being misunderstood by her own parents. So the closer Daryl gets to her, the more time he spends around her, he has to withstand a little bit of verbal abuse from her. But I think it's really worth it for him to have someone outside of his brother that he can connect to, that he can start to open up to and wonder if this is a person that he can fully open up to.
And in an interview with Aquilary, you have said, "I have a lengthy catalog of strange with which to build a character like Brooke, but climbing inside the head of a volatile teenager is a delicate matter. I want to know both, what is this catalog you speak of, and what are the risks of being inside a teenager's head?"
Well, the catalog is just the little ways that all kids, and probably all people, but I think kids wear them a little more. They can't hide them as well. Just are unique. The way that they speak, the little obsessions that they have, the way that they fidget, especially in a classroom where they're forced to be, a lot of times where they're forced to sit, you learn kind of a lot about, you know, not necessarily exactly what a kid is thinking about, but you will kind of see how they tolerate just boredom in their life. And I think so much of childhood is kind of just waiting around for the adults around you to finish their business. Well, you can get on with yours. So I'm reminded of just how patient kids have to be in a lot of situations. I've taught middle school for 8 years, so I've seen a lot of different kids. And it's definitely not a situation where like, oh, that's Brooke Noon. It's not even like these different girls are Brooke Noon. She has qualities, like interesting, quirky qualities from boys that I've seen from like all different ranges of different kids. So it's kind of putting those together in what I think is kind of still a recognizable kid. And it being kind of a touchy matter, it's as easy as it is to not necessarily dismiss what teenagers are going through, but to just be like, oh, they'll get over it. You know, middle school is really tough, or high school is tough. You'll find yourself later. It's the most important stuff in the world to them at the moment. So when I have students that are like, we're celebrating our 1 month anniversary, you know, I can't roll my eyes in my head, even though I will have to do it without letting them know. But there's so much more living for them to do, but this is really important to them. And it shouldn't be just kind of belittled or, you know, dismissed. So I've learned that any time they're at school and they find something really kind of remarkable or are moved or can't do the assignment we're working on because something is getting at them, like that's real. They're not pretending to try to get out of something. It's kind of just a way of honoring what they're going through, which is intense.
I just realized that this book is like a 300-page homage to adolescence, you know, that you yeah, honor and honor and honor over again all types of adolescent experiences. In terms of the catalog of strange and the cultural context of the 90s, I was hoping you would just read a paragraph for us.
Sure. So in this section, Kanga has just joined the basketball team. And one thing I remember from being a high school athlete is you have to dress up on game days. And this is still something I see it at middle school where kids are super proud to bring out their nicest clothes. One of the only stores that the boys have ever gone to is the Salvation Army. That's where you can really get anything there, and it's inexpensive, so it's just a great store for them to go to. So this is a description of them getting there with the purpose of finding Kanga some game day clothes. 1991 was allergic to nostalgia. If you watched 5 minutes of TV from then, you understood that people didn't sit still long enough to reminisce about the days gone by. They were too busy dancing uncontrollably, jumping from airplanes with snowboards attached to their feet, racing cars around enormous beer bottles, or splashing into vast bodies of water. Zippers on the flies of jeans were not strong enough for today's hustle and bustle, so flies now included buttons. The definition of sports had been rewritten to include cross-training, which meant being proficient at all sports at once. This required a special shoe, a cross-trainer, but rollerblades were also acceptable if you wanted to go faster than your opponents. The Salvation Army had none of the appropriate gear for 1991. Luckily for us, men's dress clothes had remained consistent since approximately the beginning of time.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Simeon Mills about his novel, The Obsoletes. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. So the most challenging part for me was wrapping my head around robot bodies. What was it like for you to work through the details of like their life systems and just their physicality?
It was a lot of fun. That was where I really got to take the familiar and try to change it. I wanted there to be not to be totally unrecognizable. I didn't also want to get too far into the weeds of exactly how their bodies worked, just because I think our own bodies are pretty mysterious. And especially when you're a teenager, your body is doing a lot of things you don't really understand. So they're not going to be totally knowledgeable about everything that's happening to them, but they are going to notice a few things. But I knew that any kind of robot would need to continually be powered. So they have to plug their fingers into a power outlet, which I like because that's something we're always told never to do from as early as we can crawl over to one. So these robots need to do that. It's just a really convenient way for them to power up. They can look for secret ways to do it in public. Their home is equipped with it. And other things like it seemed to me that if they ate food, it would just sort of ruin the insides of their bodies, which are, you know, very carefully put together, even if they don't really understand it. So eating food is a really delicate thing because that is a way that you blend in with humans, but it's also something that can spell disaster. So they have a way of stuffing plastic bags down their throats. If you want to imagine the kind of long newspaper bag that you would use to pick up dog poop, That's the kind of bag I imagine them stuffing down their throats and filling up with food in secret and then excusing themselves to the bathroom and yanking it out and flushing it. So it's kind of gross, but I really enjoyed getting into those sorts of details.
The book is called The Obsoletes, and there's this lovely thread of obsolescence throughout. Not just that if discovered and phoned in, they will become obsolete, but also the technology itself being obsolete. And early on, the parents become obsolete themselves. And I just wanted to know from your perspective, the parallel between parents becoming obsolete as just like relative figures for children growing up, and then also in regards to being robots and the technological realm.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun kind of thinking about it, and also As a parent myself, just a little kind of dread drawing the parallels between what the robots are going through and what I think all kids kind of toy with the idea of independence is kind of what it really boils down to. I kind of think the main goal of parents is to get our kids ready to be independent, so they don't really need us. And in sort of their day-to-day lives. It's always nice to be emotionally and sort of sentimentally needed and just to be for companionship and that sort of thing. But to have your kids ready to really take care of themselves. And that's a huge moment in parenting and in families. In robots, it happens a lot quicker because the kids, Daryl and Kanga, are newer models than their parents. Probably from the day that they were produced, they were more advanced than their parents, and their parents were mostly deemed obsolete. So it was almost just a way to have them blend in, to have these parent figures around. And Daryl seems to be much more okay with the idea that, yes, our parents were obsolete. This makes sense to us. We have this big book of directions. It's telling us this is what's going to happen. We can really take care of ourselves. And more specifically, I can take care of my brother. Whereas Kanga, he loves his parents. He loves them in a way that, you know, all humans love their parents too. And I think with Daryl, we're hearing from him, and it's not that he doesn't love his parents, it's that he has these conflicting sort of his own need for independence, and then there's the love that he's sort of telling himself he doesn't really need, that is also kind of an obsolete feeling for him. And I think these are things that we all kind of grapple with a little bit as we're becoming more independent. So there's a human aspect of it too.
Will you show us a scene about robot parenting, please?
Sure. But even Kanga had to realize that Mom and Dad were dreadfully obsolete. Don't get me wrong. I loved them, as I was programmed to do. But our parents were designed for a single purpose: to see Kanga and myself safely through our early years. They did an admirable job. We survived. Dad didn't run us over with his van, though he once squished the toe of Kanga's sneaker. Mom did the best she could with a battery that seemed to be perpetually drained. That was their main problem. Fully charged with electricity, Mom and Dad were thoughtful, caring parents. But this optimization lasted only about 45 minutes. After that, their efficacy declined steeply. It was sad. Mom's vocabulary would shrink to a tiny list of dialogue options, restricting her to only certain public interactions. The gas station, the liquor store, the library, and even those exchanges were embarrassing to witness. When her battery was low, Mom used to go to the pond at the park with a loaf of bread and leave us in the car while she fed the ducks. Sometimes I would find her slumped next to a power outlet at home, cross-eyed, her fingers twitching against the floor, as if she'd forgotten how to plug them in and recharge. I would have to lift Mom's fingers to the outlet and jam them in until the juice started flowing. Still, she made a point to read us bedtime stories every night. But should a one-year-old have to correct his mother on the pronunciation of the word caboose?
At one point in the book, you introduce the creator of these brothers, who makes a note that his intention for creating robots wasn't to dominate humans, but to evolve past humans, to make humans obsolete. And I was hoping that you could explain the difference between domination and evolution.
Wow. That's a... well, I think evolution is usually seen as a positive thing, where when we evolve, it's kind of like when we look into the future, we always kind of see this positive version of ourselves where we have endless amounts of time to get done with what we want. Our relationships are not strained by being stressed out or tired. So evolution would be this really hopeful state where robots and humans would live together in a kind of harmony. Maybe the robots are better than humans at everything, but there's still a recognition that, you know, they should get along. And domination is the opposite of that, where once you start trying to dominate something, it becomes probably more like a game where whatever gain you get from that is less than just the rush of winning and feeling that domination over someone else. So it's hard to think of domination really having an ending point that is satisfying to anyone other than the person or the group of people doing the dominating. So I see them as kind of two really opposite versions of the future.
It's my understanding that The Obsoletes is not meant to be allegory. Although the day that I finished reading it, I was listening to the news at the same time, and there was a story about people calling the ICE hotline to report illegal immigrants, which is the central stake for the robots in the book. And
yeah.
How close to your heart or mind is the xenophobic era that we live in now?
I think about it all the time. And it's true there isn't a sort of one-to-one allegory with this book. The robots represent this figure in today's society or in the early 90s. But I think what I would hope is that a reader would recognize something that they see, or maybe recognize something that they feel, whether it's having to hide a part of who you are, to feel like there's someone or a group or society in general that's out to get you because of some aspect of who you are. And when I hang out with kids, when I'm teaching, I feel hopeful about the future. I see them as being more accepting, just in a natural way, not in like, you know, they know they're supposed to act this way. I just see it a little more naturally with the way they interact with each other, which is in a lot of contrast to the state of, I guess, politics, I guess, of the adult world right now, where I think a lot of people are really striving for acceptance. And it felt like a little while ago we were just headed in that direction a little more naturally, and it didn't seem to be a radical idea that gaining rights would be, you know, the natural progression of things. So I'm trying to imagine my students and my children in a future where we're more on a direct path to acceptance.
Simeon Mills is a writer, cartoonist, and teacher. He majored in architecture at Columbia University and received his MFA from the University of Montana. He lives in Spokane, Washington with his wife and children. Look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin's studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.